apply a specific amount of energy to make it jump to the next higher orbit. And those are those orbits, in the case of a molecule or an atom, those orbits are quantized. They follow certain quantum rules. There are certain specific orbits that are allowed, and orbits in between are not allowed. Whereas in the case of a satellite, I can have LEOs, MEOs, GEOs, and everything in between. But the total amount of energy in an electron in a higher orbit around an atom is a significant amount of energy. But when those electrons are flowing... When those electrons are flowing in a copper wire, which means the outer single electron in the outer orbit of copper, the one that's free to move, and he is hopping from one copper molecule to the next copper molecule, the next one copper atom to the next copper atom, the total amount of kinetic energy of the current flow, I say, is extremely small compared to the amount of kinetic energy of that electron flowing around that nucleus. The electron flowing around the nucleus is moving a fraction of the speed of light. The electron that's flowing in my copper wire is moving millimeters per hour. Huge difference in velocity. So therefore, the current flow velocity and that kinetic energy, I think, is very, very, very small. That's my first guess. N2XJN, K2LIW, wait for the beep.
N2XJN. When atoms come together to form a solid, their valence electrons interact due to the Coulomb forces. And they also feel the electron field produced by their own influence and that of the other atoms. Here's what I'm driving to. Everything starts from the mechanical energy of electron. When you recall that frame of the video of the professor of the MIT, when he was changing the direction of the dipoles, when he was inserting into the coil a magnet, and you've heard that clicking sound. Okay, when he moved that magnet faster, then the current was 12 o'clock. Okay, the current was much faster, much bigger, and the electrons and the domain click faster. And the amount of energy of one electron that is added to the number of electrons is a comparison to what I used a few times when you have 15. Years old girls, and you have 15 of them, and they're pushing the car, regular small car. After a while, you need only 3 girls, and after a while, you need only one finger, one girl to sustain the motion. So, it is a mechanical energy that is causing that. Now, the electron could be pulled out of the atom just because of the mechanical velocity. Do you agree with that, N2XGM?
KC2, QIQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
I just wanted to add a comment, Dick, from what you had said before about the amount of energy difference between what's actually taking place in an atom where all of the electrons are balanced around neutrons and protons in the center of the nucleus of an atom, and that the amount of valence energy to kick it up from that level is actually very, very small by comparison. The atom itself is bonded by its own internal energy. So in other words, the velocity of each one of those electrons moving around the nucleus is bound together by the bond of the atom. So in other words, it's in complete balance, Wesley. In other words, the amount of energy to break that bond is basically you'd have to break the atom. Now that, you know how much energy that takes. That's a nuclear explosion. But when the atom itself is balanced and you basically have a crystalline lattice of copper in a wire, everything is balanced. So each electron is in perfect balance with its neutron and proton, and the amount of energy that's being shared from one atom to the next atom is the current flow itself. So that's the energy flow, which can travel at the speed of light. But the actual energy is fed from the outside. But the atoms themselves are always in well balance. Let me pass it back to Dick first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The electrons that are going around that nucleus that make up a atom or a molecule, I think they're moving at a certain percentage of the speed of light. They're moving pretty fast. But the electrons that are in the outer orbit of copper that are free to move, that do what you and I call current flow, at pretty high current flows, the average speed of them is millimeters per hour. Because the charge per electron is a significant number, 10 to the minus 19 coulombs, but there's such an extremely large number of them, Avogadro's number in 29 grams of copper, at 10 to the 22 or 10 to the 23, 10 to the 23 power copper atoms. So, and there's one electron per copper atom that's free to move in the outer orbit. So 10 to the 23 electrons having 10 to the minus 19 coulombs per means I've got 10 to the 4 power coulombs. That's a lot of charge. So at any reasonable current flow, the actual velocity, average speed of the electrons for that current flow is typically millimeters per hour, very, very slow. So the total mechanical energy created by the current flow, I am guessing, is very small. Does that seem reasonable to you at first, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, absolutely, because it's all, there again, it's mainly because the atoms themselves are balanced by their internal bond. In other words, that's what makes it copper. It's electrons, proton, neutron count that makes what it is. So the sharing of the valence electron does not necessarily have a forward direction. There's some very complex mathematics that will eventually show why it does eventually have a forward motion occasionally. But generally, it's a three-dimensional picture. Those electrons are sharing basically their energy, not just with the atom in front of it, but the one in back of it, on top of it. It's a total three-dimensional picture when that energy is being moved down the wire. So the electrons are basically just charge holders moving back and forth, allowing the current to flow in one direction without necessarily the electron being the direct carrier of the energy moving in the forward vector that we would call current flow in the wire. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, let me respond to that.
You got it, Wes.
And to exchange. See, the nature is what was first, the egg or the chicken. The faster moving electron creates the higher, the bigger magnetic field. Do you agree with that, Glenn?
Yeah, the electrons going around each individual atom are capable of making a significant magnetic field, but they're not in general all oriented in the same direction.
Degree.
So in general, a piece of copper has very little natural magnetic field. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, so when we start a theory from the mechanical properties of the electron, the faster spinning electron, the bigger the magnetic field, then we're talking about all the phenomena that happen later on just because of the existence of mechanical properties of the electron. So if the electron doesn't move, we have nothing. It doesn't exist. So question is, what is then the first factor? The first factor in the creation of the theory of understanding what's going on at a molecular level is mechanical motion. Do you agree with that?
As I see it, the electrons that are in larger and larger orbits around a copper atom, for instance, the ones that are in higher and higher orbits, their specific velocity is less and less. They're smaller. They're moving slower and slower. Just like synchronous orbit is 6,000 miles an hour, and low Earth orbit is 18,000 miles an hour. So they're moving slower. If they're moving slower around that nucleus, but they've got a larger radius, does that make more magnetic field or less magnetic field? I'm not sure.
Acceleration is important. That's what you could see from that frame of the MIT professor. The acceleration, that's what makes the magnetic field extending over the structure of an atom. And do you agree with that statement? And do you agree?
Let me backtrack for a minute. The clicking sound that you were talking about when the bar magnet was being inserted or retracted from a solenoid coil, was there an extremely high gain AC coupled amplifier, audio amplifier, connected to that coil? Is that what was making the clicking sound? Was the clicking sound coming from very high amplification of individual electron events on that solenoid coil?
Well, he made two of the experiments. One of them was simple coil and inserted the magnet and just the voltmeter and the ampermeter on it. And when he inserts he inserts the metal rod inside it slowly, and then he inserts it very fast, and he showed the difference back to you.
The answer to your question is yes, Dick.
Okay. Do we have an explanation for what the click was? Because the click cannot be individual electrons, because 10 to the 15 electrons were flowing, and I can't believe you're going to hear those. From your recollection, John, what do you believe was creating the clicks?
He stated it was the shift of the domains as they were trying to line up. That's what he said he was recording.
We'll go deeper to that. What is the domain?
Okay, so he's magnetizing a piece of ferromagnetic material, and as the individual domain, the domain is some number of atoms or molecules that are capable of moving within the lattice. That's my understanding. So you got a lattice of molecules, and some group of them are able to rotate as you apply a magnetic field, and that's when you're starting to create magnetization. Depending on their retentivity, the individual domains moving creates a change in the voltage on the solenoid around it, because the total magnetic field is making a sudden jump, and that's what's creating the click. Now it's beginning to make more sense. Do we know what kind of magnetic material was being aligned during that process? John, go ahead.
I believe it was a piece of ferrite.
Okay. So my best guess as to what a domain is the smallest grouping of molecules of the material that are able to hang together but rotate in some manner, reorient themselves, compared to the rest of the lattice, and that's the process of magnetization.
And what is the molecules contain?
What does the matter contain? I don't understand the question. That was a perfect double of both of you. West first, go ahead.
What is the molecule made from?
If it's ferrite material, I am guessing it's iron filings with some kind of a binder.
Iron filing is made from?
Iron filings are made from pieces of iron.
Iron is made from atoms. Atoms contain electrons.
Agreed. But at some particular level, whether it's an individual iron atom or it's a group of iron atoms, that I don't know, but one or the other is called a domain, a group of them that hang together, they're all friends with each other, and that particular group is capable of being reoriented, changed in direction, when a strong enough local magnetic field is applied. That's my understanding. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I understand that. What I'm trying to get is just the origin of everything. The mechanical movement of an electron makes most of the things, if not all of the things that happen to the electricity, possible. The electron can be inhalated and doesn't exist. An electron could be created from nothing by using the energy. Let's say photon can make the electron. Question is, then, for you, let me jump. If we go to the MIT professor experiment number 2, which was a coil and it was a metal rod, what he did is he inserted into the coil that was not connected to any source of the electric current. He had a voltmeter on it and ampmeter on it, and he inserted the rod inside. When he did it slow, the voltage was small and the current was small. When he did it fast, then you had a jump of the voltage and a bigger current. Was that due to the speeding up electron or was not? And to exam.
My understanding of Faraday's law tells me that if I have a loop of wire which is capable of picking up a voltage because of magnetic effects, the voltage that the loop of wire picks up is directly proportional to the rate of change of total magnetic field inside of that one-turn loop of wire. That's Faraday's law, my understanding of it. So the rate of change of total magnetic field that's inside of the area encircled by that piece of wire, that determines the exact voltage that the piece of wire picks up. So total rate of change of total magnetic field. WS, KQRIW.
But in the molecular level, is that we had this particular effect because of the electron getting to the higher orbit?
I say absolutely not. There's copper molecules in that loop of wire that goes to that ammeter and that voltmeter. And whether that loop of wire is made out of aluminum, copper, iron, anything that's mildly conductive, no matter what it's made out of, as long as it's a conductive material, Faraday's law tells me how many volts are going to be created across that wire when I know the rate of change of the total magnetic field inside of the loop of wire. I am not exciting the copper molecules when I do that. When I have a battery and a wire and a light bulb and I close the switch, I've completed the circuit, and the outer free valence electrons on the outer orbit of every one of those copper atoms in that wire, they move. I didn't excite them to a higher level. Those outer free electrons in the outer orbit of every copper molecule, they're jumping all over the place even before I close the switch. But when I close the switch, a significant number of them then decide to all move in one direction, and I call that current, and that current lights the light bulb. I didn't excite them to a higher orbit. I didn't ionize them. I only made the free ones move. I gave them a push, so to speak. The voltage is a kind of pressure. I pushed them in a particular direction, but they were bouncing around all by themselves, is my guess. OUS, KQRIW.
Well, I have a problem with that, because then now you're talking about linear motion of the electron versus the circular motion of the electron, and the vectoral forces corresponding to the circular motion of an electron. Now, the voltage is a potential, and the current is the factor that is snapped to the voltage that is existing if it's not static. Therefore, whichever motion of electron do you have, then you have the effect of the electricity in any possible way. So at this point, I may assume that the origin of everything is the mechanical properties of electric vividet.
Okay, let me show you another crazy effect that's close to what we're discussing here. I've got a 50-ohm terminating resistor. It's at room temperature. I put a very high gain, very sensitive receiver on there, and I measure the random noise coming out of that 50-ohm resistor. And I will measure at room temperature minus 114 dBm of noise power for each megacycle of bandwidth of that amplifier. I know exactly how much power is coming out of there because of the random motion of those electrons in that 50-ohm resistor at room temperature. If I now convert that 50-ohm resistor to a straight piece of copper wire with essentially 0 ohms, but it's at the exact same room temperature, and I know that those electrons are bouncing around, the outer free electrons, the valence electrons on those copper molecules of that piece of wire, I know that they're bouncing around from molecule to molecule. But when I go down to 0 ohms on that 50-ohm resistor by substituting a piece of copper, now the noise power that that receiver sees goes to zero. I got two ways of looking at that. Either the average motion of all of those electrons, when there's no voltage across the wire, the average motion adds to zero. They're jumping all over the place randomly, but the average motion goes to zero. There's no noise. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that I've got a huge impedance mismatch. I've got a 50-ohm receiver, and I put a 0-ohm resistor across it. Because of the mismatch, no power gets transferred.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If I readjusted that receiver, if I recognize the fact that a finite length of wire has 1 milliohm of resistance, and now I readjust the receiver to impedance match to 1 milliohm of copper, I will get back 114 dBm per megacycle. Ain't that crazy? I think it's related. I think the receiver is measuring the random motion of these electrons. And that's part of what I think we're discussing here. Before we force them to go in one direction with a battery or a power supply, or before we push them with a changing magnetic field in a loop of wire. Maybe this helps a little bit. You got it, Wes. K2RIW.
G2QIQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn. Make that one clearer for us.
See, I think the thing that always confuses everyone is years and years and years ago, they used to show, like in basic electronics, a whole bunch of electrons running down a wire. And when you attached a battery, you had your copper wire, and all the electrons were moving in the direction of the current flow. And that was probably the worst thing that they could have ever done for anybody who's ever going to try to study this model at the atomic level. That is so inaccurate that what really what's going on. You have the valence electron that is basically able to exchange charge from one atom to the next because it loosely, in a loosely connected orbit to every other similar atom next to it. So if it's copper, the copper atom next door means its ability to exchange charge between atoms. Not necessarily that the electron is bumping and moving and jumping around all over the place. Yes, it is. It could be coming back and coming back to its same atom or being exchanged with the one next to it. The thing that's important to realize here is the charge that's being exchanged so that not exactly the direct travel of the electron, but when you have currents flowing down a wire, it's the exchange of charge from one atom to the next and the potential energy across the wire that's determining the direction of the current flow. So it's not, when you're looking at the atom by itself, with the fixed number of electrons, protons, and neutrons, that is a balanced item that that count is exact. Otherwise, if it wasn't exact, protons, neutrons, and electrons, it wouldn't be copper, or it wouldn't be aluminum, or whatever its exact atomic count is. That's what makes the material the material. But the exchange of charge from one atom to the next does not directly relate to each individual electron. It's the balance in a three-dimensional structure of how that charge is being exchanged between the copper atoms to the energy that's being applied to the whole structure. Let me pass back to you.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
I get a golden bagel.
That's okay. But now, look what happens when we heat it up, Glenn. Assume now that I've made this copper wire very fine in diameter, and I've made it long enough so that I forced it to be something like a 50-ohm resistor, and I wound it back and forth on itself so it's not a solenoid. I'm not making a magnetic field. I'm trying to cancel the inductance, so to speak. So out of copper or carbon or anything else, I've made a solid 50-ohm resistor, and I know it makes 114 dBm per megacycle at room temperature. And because it is solid, every one of those molecules are not flowing like a liquid or like a gas. They are not a fluid. It is a solid. However, when I make it hotter, I know that the average kinetic energy of each atom or molecule goes up. That's what temperature is. What I think they're doing is they're all held together by local electrostatic attraction or whatever. They are in a matrix. It's like a whole bunch of springs in between them all. And when I go to a higher temperature, they are bouncing back and forth on their springs, but they've got a greater amount of bouncing action. With the higher temperature, with the greater amount of bouncing spring action, like a whole bunch of baseballs and a great big three-dimensional monkey. You know, I got a whole bunch of baseballs and a whole bunch of springs between them in three-dimensional space. And they're all bouncing around in funny ways because I punched some of them, so to speak. And when I go to a higher temperature, they really are moving with greater amount of deflection. And by some means that I don't yet completely understand, I get more noise power output from that 50-ohm resistor when it's hotter. So these electrons that are bouncing more violently, these molecules that are bouncing on the springs more violently, somehow make greater random current flow. That's what I'm seeing when I see greater noise.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I wonder if that's approximately how you see that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, it's been a few years since I took this course, but my direct understanding of temperature and its effect on the direct effect on the electrons within a physical structure, let's say copper, for example, would be that the velocity of orbits at one temperature is one velocity. And as the temperature increases on that structure, the electron orbits increase in their velocity. So the exchange rates between, even though that there's no static current in a forward, because there's no external potential across the structure, that the interrelationship between valent bonds extending their valent energy from one atom to the next will be increased because of the increased velocity of the electron orbits. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm having a problem with that one, Glenn. The individual electron orbits are quantized, obvious by the fact you tell me what substance it is, formaldehyde. I'll tell you exactly what lines of absorption or emission it'll give you in a spectrometer. And even if I make it hotter or colder, I get the exact same absorption or emission lines. Those lines do not move in frequency because I've heated it up. They may get louder, but they don't move in frequency. That leads me to believe that those orbits stay the same. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
I think the energy exchange rate remains the same. In other words, the velocity is increasing, but in other words, because it's a sum balance, as long as the material itself is the same atomic count, and it's happening equally across all of the, in order to maintain the same rate of balance at higher velocity, all of the molecules around it would have to be at a similar equilibrium of temperature. So the rate of exchange between each one would be the same because all of the orbits would be changing simultaneously, even though their velocities are increased. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Can I risk a certain hypothesis?
Hold on now. I've got to... We can't leave this one. There's something wrong here, Glenn. If I want to excite that molecule, if I want to take the lower electron and bring it up to the very next orbit that he's allowed to have, there's a very specific amount of energy I must give that molecule to do that. In other words, however number of electron volts are required for him to go from the lower orbit to the next orbit up, I must inject exactly that amount of energy. The way I do it is to put in exactly that wavelength, E equals H nu, if you know what I mean. I inject that amount of energy by putting in that wavelength that does the excitation. As such, that leads me to believe that the amount of energy required from the first orbit to the second orbit to the third orbit, each one of those has a very quantized, fixed amount of energy requirement. That's the reason why, as it absorbs energy and those electrons go up, it absorbs at a very specific wavelength. And when those electrons come back down to their rest orbits, they give off a very specific amount of energy. That's why the emission line is a very specific wavelength. So absorption and emission lines are very characteristic of that atom of material, copper, formaldehyde, whatever. And those wavelengths do not move simply because the material is hotter or colder. They get louder or softer, but the wavelengths do not move. The energy requirement to jump from one electron orbit to the next orbit does not change, is my understanding. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. In other words, the amount of energy to move from one orbital to the next is an external factor, but the velocity of the orbit is different with temperature. I believe that that's the difference, and there's no difference in frequency between the rate at which electrons are being absorbed, and because, in other words, the rate at which energy transfers is fixed. So in other words, if you were going to look at the exchange rate of charge down a wire, the exchange rate of charge down the wire is the speed of light, excluding velocity factors and things like coax and stuff like that. But basically, the exchange of charge from atom to atom does move at the speed of light. But the velocity of an orbit can still be increased without affecting that, and or the amount of energy from moving one electron to the next orbital level. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dick?
I don't agree, Glenn. You cannot change the velocity of an orbit without changing the orbital diameter. If there's a fixed amount of electrostatic attraction between those protons and those electrons, there's a very specific orbital diameter, a very specific orbital speed that makes that balance. That doesn't change as a function of temperature. Temperature is an average kinetic energy, not of the electron cloud. It's the average kinetic energy of the total molecule. If I heat up a solid substance, those molecules, the total molecule is translated in X, Y, and Z on its springs of its lattice, and maybe they're rotating, the total molecule is rotating, but the average kinetic energy of the total molecule is temperature. The total energy of the electrons is fixed when they're in their orbit, obvious by the fact that the absorption lines and the emission lines don't move. Those velocities, those diameters of electron orbits are not changing. Otherwise, those wavelengths would change. Temperature, I think, is total motion of molecule in translation or rotation. That's my guess. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
I think we had this argument once before, and I'm going to yield on this one because I think what it's coming down to is you're suggesting that that what's actually happening here is that the whole atoms of copper in a solid are moving, and I'm saying that they're not. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When they move violently enough, because I've heated them up enough, they break their bonds of their springs, and then you and I call it a liquid. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, no, I understand where you're going with this one, but I don't want to argue tonight. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We're not arguing. We're trying to find out what the hell Mother Nature is telling us. John, I know you got some comments on all this. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Could I make one more comment then?
Now, there's a fee involved, but go ahead, Glenn.
I had to let the commercial go through. The charge exchanges from basically one atom to the next in a conductor at a maximum rate of the speed of light, C. That's your boundary for charge exchange. But when temperature is increasing, there's a direct relationship within a specific atom that, in other words, it's not just one velocity that's changing in a specific orbit. They change together. In other words, if you were to look at the spacing of an electron to a proton in comparison to its mass and to keep it in balance, it's hugely different. But the relationship from a valence energy bond to a lower orbital bond with respect to the nucleus and the proton are limited by an exchange rate at the speed of light. But the relationship between the energy from one shell to the next is also very, very tightly bound between them, regardless of their velocities. So they do move together, Dick, and they are balanced as part of their bond that makes them their specific material. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm not arguing, but I don't agree. If I suddenly close a switch at the end of a piece of wire, and I'm putting on a load, at the other end of the piece of wire, the battery senses the current flow at the speed of light. A nanosecond per foot is the velocity at which the battery senses the new load, the new current level. But the electrons flowing in that wire are like marbles in a pipe. When one marble goes out of the end, because you suddenly close the switch, a marble must go into the front end at the speed of light. The propagation of the difference in the pressure along all of those marbles in the light and in the pipe, that happens at the speed of light. But the individual electron entering that pipe, entering that wire, doesn't come out of the other end for many hours. So the real speed of the electron at best is millimeters per hour on average. But you sense the fact that an imbalance was created at one end, and at the speed of light, the other end senses the change in pressure on those molecules. So the change in pressure in the molecules is sensed at the speed of light. It's like a sound wave traveling in water in a hose, if you know what I mean. But the flow of water in the hose could be extremely slow. The flow of electrons in that copper wire, on average, is extremely slow. That's a paradox. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Oh, I agree. As I said, I don't equate directly the rate of charge that's changing across the wire. As if that's bound by the speed of light, but the direct relationship of the electron in a balanced atom is not directly... There is a reason why, and there is a count to why, that the amount of electrons that do migrate through the wire to a certain amount of current density, that why that electron, which you basically calculated for us before. But what's actually happening here is the charge that's moving, but the relationship between orbitals and temperature are bound together. In other words, they must stay together. That cannot change, although their velocities can. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If the orbit of the electron is fixed by the 1 over distance squared of electrostatic attraction, between the protons and the electrons, if the gravity force, so to speak, which is electrostatic force, is fixed, and if the energy between those electron orbits is fixed, then the velocity has to be fixed. You can heat up the copper as much as you want, and those copper molecules are going to be translating more between each other, bouncing on their springs, moving X, Y, and Z in translation, rotating maybe in X, Y, and Z back and forth on their springs. So they're doing some rotating back and forth, they're doing some translating back and forth, they're bouncing in a complicated way. But the individual electrons around those protons, around that nucleus, it does not see temperature until you get to temperatures that create ionization. And we're not going anywhere near there. The best way to ionize is to put in an extremely specific amount of wavelength, and now you absorb or emit that wavelength. Those electron velocities around that nucleus, since the orbit is not changing in diameter, since the orbit is not changing in energy, the velocity cannot change, is my impression, Glenn. Go ahead.
I have a comment on temperature.
Well, what I'm saying here, Dick, is that because the velocity is increasing, the orbitals are all moving up together, the release valve is the valent shell. That's the one that transfers. So, of course, it's the rate of transfer that's the release valve, so to speak, that allows the additional orbits to increase but they increase together. And the valence is what actually does the final transfer at the end between atom to atom, and that's the noise that you're hearing. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When you said all of the orbits all the velocities are increasing in total, are they increasing because of your method of measurement while the total molecule or the total atom rotates? Is that what you mean? Or is there real rotational velocity in radians per second or in meters per second, however you want to measure it? Is the meters per second or radians per second of an electron around that nucleus, are you saying all of them go to a brand new velocity? I can't believe that, Glenn. Go ahead.
It's my understanding that they do, and the vector of their rotation isn't exact. In other words, they're not rotating in orbits that are aligned geometrically in a planar arrangement. One can rotate at so many degrees apart from the next, and they will actually rotate in three-dimensionally apart from each other. So in other words, one is as the charge balance of energy inside there is increasing with temperature, it moves up, but they stay balanced to within each other. But in doing so, the electron in the valence energy can swap or exchange charge from atom to atom at a much greater rate because of that, at the higher temperature level. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Three gas air molecules in a container are
completely different, Dick.
No, I think there's a relationship. They're bouncing around crazy, and the rate at which they bounce, their average kinetic energy of motion, is temperature. In the case of a solid, like a copper lattice, a bunch of copper atoms in a lattice, they are bouncing around on their springs as a function of temperature. You've got the free outer valence electrons that are free to move in random manner from one copper atom to the next. They're doing that naturally. As I heat up the copper, and the individual atoms of copper are now bouncing and translating and rotating, the total atom is got more motion. Now the electrons that join and don't join, join and bounce and whatever off of that outer free electron valence shell, have more kinetic energy, the free ones, because of the greater motion of the things that they're bouncing off of, copper atoms. Therefore, they bounce more rapidly, they move more rapidly, they make more noise. The real source of the noise is the translational bouncing of the individual copper atoms on their springs of that lattice. I'm proposing that as a hypothesis. Over to you, Glenn.
In the gases, Dick, I completely agree. In the gases, the velocities of the orbits are fixed. They have to be. Otherwise, that's one of the definitions of a gas at the atomic level, is that the velocities are fixed. And then basically what's happening there is that you are seeing free motion of the actual total atom itself. It can expand and contract and follow the laws of natural gases. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
All stand by now. The individual air molecules are not expanding or contracting. The total mass of the total volume by PV equals NRT goes up because the bouncing velocity when they hit the wall increases, and you and I call that greater pressure. The pressure goes up because they're hitting the wall more rapidly because they're moving more rapidly. They got more kinetic energy when they hit the wall. So the velocity of the free-moving gas air molecules is a function of temperature. I'm saying that the electron cloud of a free valence electron in copper atoms are very similar to the air molecules. They are bouncing from one copper atom to the next, and if the copper atoms themselves have greater translational velocity, those electrons get more kinetic energy as they bounce from one copper atom to the next. You and I call that greater motion of the electrons greater amount of noise. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I'm agreeing with you in terms of the natural gas. In other words, in gases, that bouncing effect is for real. That does take place, as best as we know, I think, as of today. But when inside the copper itself, that's not the case. The velocity does increase in the in solids. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
The velocity increase of solid increases as a function of temperature. Yes. Velocity of what? Is it the velocity of the total molecule, or is every one of the orbits of every one of the electrons at a brand new velocity? And if so, when they've got to balance themselves with the electrostatic force, how do they do that?
My understanding is that that's what's happening inside a solid, that they do increase, they move in proportion, and then the energy is exchanged at a faster rate at the valent level.
I'm going to accept that the energy is exchanging at a faster rate at the valence level. But the individual orbits of all of the non-valence electrons, are you telling me the non-valence electrons go to higher velocity orbits, greater diameter orbits? What is changing with the non-valence electron orbits in copper molecules, copper atoms, as I heat them up? The non-valence electron orbits, what are they doing, Glenn?
My understanding is that they move to higher velocities, they're moving to higher orbits, but the relationship between the orbits are fixed. And then what the limiting factor is the valence shell, which because of their increased orbits and their increased velocities are allowing more energy to exchange at the valence level to keep the structure balanced.
If the orbits of the non-valence electrons are going to larger radius, that means they're further away from the protons. That means that they are experiencing less electrostatic attraction. That means that their velocity has to be lower. Larger orbits are lower in velocity if you're going to balance electrostatic force. By the same token, a satellite around the Earth, a larger orbit must be a lower velocity. Yes, it's got more energy, but it's got to be a lower velocity. That's a brand new wavelength, Eric. It wouldn't have the same absorption and emission line. Over to you, Glenn.
My understanding, Vic, is that not only are the orbits aren't all aligned on a planar scale, like in other words, on a flat piece of paper. There's not only the charge, is also the angles of the individual orbits. So in other words, if you were to look at one, let's say it's at 0 degrees, there's another one at, let's say, 90, and then, you know, 280, you know, but in other words, divided up, balanced. The angle at which the orbits go together also shifts as well, and that's what makes up the difference in charge, Dick.
Makes up the difference in charge of what? Each of the protons have the same charge. Each of the electrons have the same charge. The amount of electrostatic attraction between them is a function of 1 over distance squared. You balance that all out, and you try to make the wavelengths come out the same, which is the amount of energy between one orbital radius and the next orbital radius, to make that all come out the same. I don't think you can change those. So we've got a difference on this one. We'll eventually get a little greater understanding. John, I know you've wanted to ask a bunch of questions. Go ahead, John, K2RAW, and then you pass it to Wesley. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, quick question was, if the velocity increases in the orbiting electron, its distance would have to increase, I would imagine, from the nucleus. And my basic question originally was going to be, in a simple hydrogen atom, does the electron path have precession? That was one of my questions I wanted to ask.
In the case of an external force, whenever something's in orbit, whenever something's rotating, like a top on the table, and gravity is trying to pull the top down so it doesn't stay, you know, straight up and down, so to speak, you're going to get precession. So if I, many of these materials, if I create a disturbing force like an external magnetic field, I think I'm going to get precession. But you said something that I don't agree with. You said that if it moves faster, it goes into a larger orbit. Good common sense, no. Let's assume now that I've got something that's in low Earth orbit. It's moving at 17,500 miles an hour. It's 200 nautical miles above the surface of the Earth. And I suddenly turn on a rocket motor, and I do a blast for 30 solid seconds. And I increase the speed from 17,500 to 18,000. What's going to happen? The greater velocity is, yes, at first going to move it to a greater altitude. It's not going to stay in the same orbit altitude. It's going to go into a higher orbit on the opposite side. Whatever you do with delta velocity at, let's say, the 6 o'clock position of the orbit, you're going to get the maximum effect at the 12 o'clock. So I've made a blast at 6 o'clock. Let me do it the other way around. Let's assume this is a polar orbit. And as I pass the South Pole, I turn on the rocket and I move faster. I go from 17,500 to 18,000. And now that orbit normally is going to carry it up to going above the North Pole. Let me drop. As it goes above the North Pole, it's not going to be 200 miles above the Earth anymore. It's going to be 1,000 miles above the Earth. And then it's going to continue in that orbit, and it's going to go back down to the South Pole, right back to where it was, 200 miles an hour, 200 miles above the Earth. If you make an impulse energy change in an orbit, you don't change the altitude at that location. You change the altitude 180 degrees away. So increased velocity at the north, at the South Pole makes the orbit higher at the North Pole. And now I've got a brand new elliptical orbit. And if I want to end up at a higher altitude, and by the way, when it's at the 1,000-mile altitude above the North Pole, it's moving slower. It's probably moving at 17,000 instead of 17,500 or 18,000. So it was moving 17,500, beautiful circular orbit, North Pole to South Pole, back to the North Pole. At the South Pole, I do a blast. It goes from 17,500 to 18,000. It now passes by the North Pole at a 1,000-mile altitude instead of 200, and it's moving only 17,000 miles an hour. Then it comes back down to the South Pole region, speeding up back to 18,000 at 200 miles above. If I want the higher orbit, I must make a minimum of 2 burns. I do the 1 burn at the South Pole that makes it higher above the North Pole. While I'm at apogee at the North Pole, I do a 2nd burn, and now the whole darn orbit is 1,000 miles above the Earth everywhere. So the craziness of central force motion, let me drop, which is 1 over inverse square law, 1 over radius squared, and whether you're doing it with gravity or electrostatic attraction, you do the exact same thing. So the greater velocity gives me a higher orbit somewhere else where I'm moving slower. Do a second burn at the higher orbit, now I've got a brand new circular orbit at a lower velocity. Total energy is greater, orbit is greater, velocity is lower. Ain't that crazy, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, it is. But it makes perfect sense. Another thing, I think Glenn hit something there when he was talking about, I don't think any electrons leave the wire at all. It may be just the energy transfer, the electrostatic charge or whatever of the electrons transferring from one atom to another on the valence area. Maybe no electrons at all are moving down the wire.
I think I figured out how to explain it.
You got it, Glenn.
Let's say you have a geosynchronous orbit of one satellite that's traveling 22 miles above Earth, and it's falling to Earth as fast as it's moving away. Can you picture this? Across the equator.
You said 22 miles. I know you mean 22,000 miles. So 22,400 miles above the equator, I've got a geosynchronous orbit, and I'm moving at roughly 6,000 miles an hour. If I completely stop the forward motion, it will start falling toward the surface of the Earth. And at first, it's got zero velocity, but it's going to continuously speed up as it smacks into the Earth's surface. Over to you, John. Glenn.
Okay, so now you've got that orbit. And now you put something above it in a higher orbit. Now, that's actually aligned along the equator, but it's no longer geosynchronous. And that orbit will pass, those two satellites will eventually pass each other, but at different rates of time. Are you following me so far?
Assuming they're both circular orbits, one of them is 22,600 miles up. It makes one revolution per 24 hours. The higher circular orbit is slower in miles per hour. It's slower in angular rate. So the one at synchronous orbit is going to be making more revolutions per month than the higher orbit one. Over to you, Glenn.
So if you had exchange information between those two satellites, and the only time that they could exchange information is when they came next to each other, that would be the rate of change between those two orbits. Are you following me so far?
Okay. If I make the higher orbit, let me pick a number, 50 feet higher, the two will cross each other once per month. Go ahead, Glenn.
Now let's say I'm going to make another geosynchronous orbit. I'm going to have one across the equator, and now I'm going to have another geosynchronous orbit that's going across over the, let's say instead of being around the equator, it's going up over the South Pole and along the North Pole. Are you following me so far with that one?
Yeah, you've got two orbits that are orthogonal to each other. One is a equatorial orbit, one is a polar orbit. And so far, they're both at the same altitude, which means twice per orbit, I stand a chance of smacking into each other. Go ahead.
Okay, twice, right. Now we raise it a little bit more, okay, to a slightly higher altitude like we did the other one, but it's no longer, no longer on the same path around the equator as the geosynchronous orbit, but it's just a little bit higher. Can you see the difference in rate and change now? Because it's at a higher orbit, that they're not going to cross at the same time when it's going over the polar orbit.
Yeah, the rate at which they encounter each other when they're both in the same plane of orbit is going to be something very slow if there's very little difference between the altitudes, the orbital radius. If now the two orbits are at right angles, the plane of the orbits are at right angles to each other, although the orbits are crossing at a particular rate, the two satellites are not at the intersection at the same time, and so now the chances of an encounter is going to become extremely small. Once per year, they come near each other when they're at right angles and at different altitudes. Go ahead.